Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the American Thanksgiving story is one of cooperation and coexistence between white European settlers and Native peoples. But the real story is much darker. What really happened in the first Thanksgiving? And first, how does deep listening to nature promote biodiversity and a better relationship with the natural world? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. How much does nature speak? How well do we as humans listen? What secrets of animals and plants are accessible? If only we would take time to listen. And how much would listening to nature alter our relationship with the natural world and help us with commitments to biodiversity and the most gentle relationship between humanity and its nature around us? Our guest today is Karen Bacher. She is professor of geography and an associate at the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of British Columbia, and is visiting professor at Harvard's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. And she's the author of The Sounds of Life, How Digital Technology is Bringing Us Closer to the World of Animals and Plants. Professor Karen Bacher, thank you very much for joining us. The first question, as I was reading through this, thinking of the sound of nature, the first species that comes to mind is, of course, the whale. And you begin telling that narrative. What has listening to whales taught us about nature?
So deep listening to nature is, of course, a venerable and ancient tradition. And the book tells some of the stories of the longstanding practices of listening to nature, but then weaves into that a story about digital technology, how we're using digital technology to listen to animals like whales, and how we are discovering some astounding things about species that we thought we knew quite well. So the first couple of chapters of the book tell the story of the scientific discovery of whale song, of the intricacy of whale communication, and not just humpbacks, which many listeners may be familiar with, stretching all the way back several decades to the work done by scientists Roger and Katie Payne. And of course, not only their research, but also the platinum best-selling nature album called Whale Song that came to public attention, was played at the UN General Assembly, sent out on that gold record that NASA sent up into space in case the aliens ever find it. They'll know there's intelligent life on Earth, humans, Homo sapiens, and also whales. So there's a long history of us being fascinated by whale sound. But as I explore in the book, there's a new chapter in that story. And part of that chapter is extending our understanding of the amazing communication of species like whales, who spend a lot of their time beneath the water. And until recently, we weren't able to really record those sounds in any detail or actually to decode them. What helps us is artificial intelligence and bioacoustics, which are little digital recording devices that they can be as small as your smartphone. And what scientists are doing are installing those little recording devices everywhere from the depths of the ocean to the highest mountaintops, from the Arctic to the Amazon. And we're making fascinating discoveries. I'll just mention one, which is recently we discovered that whales, which we thought had a certain kind of repertoire, we discovered a whole other range of sounds they make. Mothers, when they give birth, mother whales whisper to their babies at tonalities and at frequencies and volumes we had never been previously able to hear. And scientists believe they're doing that to shield their babies from predators, because of course, if you're making loud sounds, it's more easy for the predators to find you. So although these animals are very well studied, we only realized that mother whales whisper very, very recently. And that's just one of the findings I talk about in the book.
And it's so fascinating. Now, the early stages of some of this research was conducted by the U.S. Navy, correct? And it seemed like the Navy kind of protected a lot of their discoveries from the scientific community. There seems to be a potential relationship there between military security, those sorts of issues, and the insights that the scientific community have gained over the course of the last few decades.
Scientific bioacoustics has a lineage of more than 100 years. As soon as humans invented microphones, we started recording the sounds of animals. One of the first scientists to do this was a Slovenian biologist, Ivan Regan, who played recorded insect sounds to other insects and observed their responses. One of his best known experiments, he actually arranged for a male insect to call a female of the same species using a then brand new technology, the telephone. So these were quirky people lugging essentially pretty much a minivan's worth of equipment out into the jungle to record sounds. This kind of research was not for the faint of heart, not mainstream, except for the Navy. And the reason the Navy got interested was because in the post-World War II period, the world's armies began conducting classified research into marine sound as a foundation for anti-submarine warfare. And what they found is that underwater acoustics contain a trove of information because sound travels much better underwater than light. Sound travels about four times as fast as light. And what they found is that there's a particular deep water channel about half a mile below the surface. And in that channel, which exists because of specific physics of the ocean, temperature, salinity, pressure, that channel can be used like a long distance telephone line. It can transmit sound very, very long distances across the ocean. So they would drop their microphones, the Navy's microphones, into this channel and listen for the sound of Soviet submarines, listen for the sound of torpedoes. They thought they had stumbled upon, you know, the best ever sort of secret weapon in the Cold War. But the use of the SOFAR channel was really disrupted by these very bizarre underwater sounds. Navy technicians didn't know what made them. There were grunts and whistles and ululations and sounds that sounded like a strange Morse code. Only later did they realize that these were the sounds of whales that dive deep into the ocean, and whales use the SOFAR channel to communicate hundreds or perhaps even thousands of miles across entire ocean basins with one another. So the Navy had just rediscovered what the whales had perfected through evolution is long distance underwater acoustic communication. So the Navy kept those findings secret, and they have only really recently been revealed, with a lot of that research being declassified. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of this bioacoustics research is not well known, and maybe put a little bit of a break on the scientific research. But that has all changed in the past 10 years. And the book tells the story of digital bioacoustics being used to record the sounds of not only whales, but also elephants, turtles, bats, peacocks, coral. And a lot of this sound is happening beyond our human hearing range. It's either happening in the high ultrasonic frequencies above which we can hear, or the low infrasonic. Their frequency is too low for us to hear. So it turns out that humans, compared to most animals on the planet, we're actually pretty poor listeners. There's a cacophony, a symphony of sound out there, and most of it is simply inaudible to us, or was, until digital bioacoustics came along.
Now, you gave that list of different species who are communicating. At the end there, you slipped in coral, because when we think of nature making sounds, we're all very familiar with animals who vocalize. And so we understand that, I mean, the idea that nature makes sounds is not unique to us. That was something I found particularly fascinating, is it's not just animals, but there's quite a bit of evidence. There's just knowledge, you know, growing knowledge that plants communicate with one another. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, there's a whole chapter on plants. Now, coral are actually technically animals, or some call them planimals, because they're very unusual animals. But let's talk about coral. Coral larvae are one of the species I talk about in the book to illustrate the fact that many species across the tree of life are sensitive to sound in ways we had not previously realized, mostly because we haven't even bothered to ask the question, but that includes species without ears or any apparent means of hearing. Coral larvae are tiny, to put it highly technically, tiny little blobs. They are microscopic. They have no central nervous system. They have cilia, little hairs all around their bodies. So one wouldn't think this is not an obvious candidate for species that could detect sound, and yet they do. The research was done by Steve Simpson and colleagues through a very ingenious methodology, they found that coral larvae can not only detect sound, but they can distinguish between the sound of, let's say, music and the sound of a reef. They can distinguish between the sound of a healthy reef and an unhealthy or degraded reef. And moreover, they can distinguish between the sound of any random reef and their home reef. Coral larvae, it turns out, sonically imprint in a way we do not understand on the sound of their home reef at the moment of their birth. They're born in these fantastic underwater mass spawning events that often occur at the full moon. We don't know why. They wash out to sea, but at that moment of birth, they must imprint on the coral reef lullaby. And then hearing that sound, weeks, months later, they swim across the open ocean to settle back on their home reef. Now, this overturns a lot of what we understood about coral larvae. We thought they were hapless creatures pushed here and there by wind, waves, currents. And it turns out, just like the salmon, you know, making these great migrations, they're migrating back home. And the uncanny abilities of these seemingly simple creatures to have finely attuned senses of hearing orders of magnitude greater than our own is pretty astounding. The mechanical explanation here is that their cilia function like the cilia in your ears. What is enabling you to listen to me right now is the hairs inside your ear vibrating. You can think of coral as little inside out ears. They've got cilia all over their bodies. That's a startling story. But what's even more startling is that most of the species scientists have looked at are also equally sensitive to sound, including plants.
When thinking of coral, there's no species that's as threatened at this point as the bleached coral reefs. And so I would think these insights could provide some tremendous information about preservation of coral and protection of biodiversity.
Yeah, and that's a hopeful note that runs through the book. So bioacoustics is an amazing tool for monitoring, for detecting the sounds that species make, for linking this to complex behaviors. Like, for example, we've uncovered a whole world we didn't know of bat behavior or turtle behavior. But beyond that, we're opening up a new toolkit for biodiversity conservation. Coral is a great example. So it turns out, because coral larvae are attracted to the sounds of healthy reefs, what scientists are now doing is doing underwater playback experiments. You put the sound of a healthy reef, a speaker, on a degraded reef, and you attract fish and coral larvae back. They settle. It's like music therapy for nature. You're a coral reef DJ. And what that does is it accelerates the regeneration of the reef. Now, this is not going to save the world's coral reefs from, you know, ocean warming and acidification and climate change. But what it will do is enable scientists engaged in desperately trying to triage and save some coral reefs, it will help. And it may turn the tide to help save some of the very threatened reefs off the coast of Indonesia, or perhaps the Great Barrier Reef. So that's a silver lining in otherwise what's a pretty worrisome time in biodiversity conservation.
Let's listen to coral reef and the shrimp living on it in this ecosystem.
To be completely hopeful, completely optimistic, if we do finally commit and reverse some of the effects of climate change and take very seriously greenhouse gas emissions, it seems to suggest that the coral that we've lost could possibly be replenished, of course, with that caveat that we have to stop acidifying the ocean.
There's resilience, there's regeneration. So I don't want to overplay it. I don't want to give false hope, but rather a note of cautious optimism. You know, notwithstanding the tremendous threats that coral reefs are facing, this is one small tool in what needs to be a much bigger toolkit. Bioacoustics is often, you know, now being deployed in other ways as well in conservation. In the book, I tell the story of the North Atlantic right whale that's been highly threatened, nearly hunted to extinction, only maybe 350 members of that species left, and bioacoustics is now being used to locate the whales in real time off the east coast of North America to tell ship's captains where the whales are. The ship's captains, by law, must slow down, move out of the area. Fishers must stop fishing. The use of bioacoustics here has actually led to a dramatic reduction in deaths of whales by ship strikes. Actually, since the program was implemented in 2019, no whale deaths by ship strikes. So imagine a group of 350 whales, because they live off the Gulf of St. Lawrence, a group of 350 whales is controlling the movements of tens of thousands of cargo ships in a watershed that's home to 45 million people. Whale lanes in the ocean now take precedence over shipping lanes. And we're doing the same thing off the West Coast, the California coast. Similar approaches have been adopted for tuna, endangered tuna, off the coast of Australia. Again, these are not panaceas, but what they do suggest is there's a new sort of regime of environmental governance, bioacoustic space, that could make a real difference in helping some endangered species survive.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the book, The Sounds of Life, How Digital Technology is Bringing Us Closer to the World of Animals and Plants, with its author, Karen Bakker, of the University of British Columbia and the Harvard Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies. So, Karen, one of the things I found really fascinating, and you, at the beginning of our conversation, pointed out that bioacoustics or listening to nature isn't new. And one of the themes of the book is what we can learn from indigenous approaches to knowledge and indigenous approaches to nature. How much have indigenous communities and indigenous philosophy helped to frame the importance of bioacoustics and this sort of research?
Thank you for asking that. I think it's really important that Western scientists acknowledge the depth of traditional knowledge in indigenous science and indeed indigenous data sovereignty when discussing these issues. And throughout the book, I give examples of deep listening by indigenous communities that anticipates and it has often a more subtle understanding of non-human sound than Western science. Robin Wall Kimmerer has a lovely quote in her amazing book, Braiding Sweetgrass, where she says, you know, I smile when my colleagues say I discovered X. That's kind of like Columbus claiming to have discovered America. Experiments are not about discovery, but about listening and translating the knowledge of other beings. Leroy Little Bear, who's a Blackfoot philosopher, says the human brain is like a station on the radio dial. Parked in one spot, it is deaf to all the other stations, the animals, rocks, trees, simultaneously broadcasting across the whole spectrum of sentience. So there's a longstanding tradition in both, you know, indigenous philosophy, indigenous law, indigenous science of deep listening, a very fine-grained detailed knowledge. In the first two chapters, I talk about the knowledge that the Inupiat of Barrow, Alaska, the deep knowledge they have of the bioacoustics of the ocean, which is a very diverse and rich ecosystem off the coast of Alaska. And they were the ones to guide scientists and help them formulate the hypotheses that led to a lot of our scientific understanding of whales. And so the book is also then an attempt to encourage dialogue between these two traditions. And more than that, I argue that indigenous listening, deep listening, because it is rooted in place and in sense of traditional territory and ethics responsibility, provides really important ethical guideposts for these new technologies, which have the potential not only to open up this wonderful world of non-human communication, but run the risk of allowing us to further exploit or dominate non-humans. And we desperately need some ethical guideposts for the newfound powers these technologies give us.
No, absolutely. And part of what this is suggesting then is a different relationship with nature. I think of the way that nature has sounds and forms of communication. That's what I found particularly fascinating, is the way in which different animals, different species, different plants are communicating with one another. Our knowledge of the way in which whales communicate has shifted our understanding of whales, an acknowledgement of at least some degree of sentience among whales, and certainly shifted our attitudes about things like consumption of whale meat or, you know, hunting of whales for commercial purposes. Is there a real potential here that this could really fundamentally alter just the way in which we view nature, that it's no longer simply a resource to be consumed by humans, but there needs to be much more of a symbiotic relationship between humanity and nature.
That is a long-standing debate, as you know, and it goes back, you know, Aristotle's divide. Humans have rational souls, animals have sensitive souls, plants have vegetative souls. The hierarchy. Descartes, I think therefore I am, but man alone possesses reason. And so there's a long tradition. Wittgenstein, famous for saying, if a lion could speak, we could not understand him. Thomas Nagel, the philosopher, further arguing that, you know, even if bats had consciousness, we could never understand that because bat language could never be translated to humans. So this is a long standing debate which touches on not only sentience, but also consciousness and intelligence. I should say that most bioacoustics researchers avoid that debate. They work on information and communication. We know that a vast array of species, including plants, are capable of sensing ecologically complex information from sound and decoding that and behaving accordingly. There's that great experiment I talk about in the book, Heidi Apple at the University of Toledo. She plays different sounds to plants. And not only can they detect whether the sound is, let's say, insects or rain, they can even distinguish between an insect that is the predator of their species versus a non-threatening insect. They have their sense of hearing is orders of magnitude more sensitive than our own. But that is all couched in the language of information theory, the communication of information between sender and receiver, signal to noise ratio, ecologically relevant information. Now, would we make the leap to then argue that non-humans indeed have language? It depends on how you define language. If you demand that it contains symbolic content in the same way human language does, well, we are finding some more evidence, for example, of complex combinatorial aspects in primate language. But if you adopt a more expansive definition of language, and again, this is controversial, one can definitely find forms of language in other species, for example, species that have individual names. The bat research alone is fascinating. We know that, you know, bats hold grudges, remember favors, use vocalizations that encode individual kin and family identity. Baby bats engage in vocal learning, just like humans do. They babble. Parents babble at the babies, babies babble back. Babies learn to speak adult bat. They learn their family songs, which are a marker of culture. We could continue redefining our definition of language to be so anthropocentric that that bat way of communicating would not be considered language, but I think it's time for a healthy debate. And in so doing, we run up against some pretty fierce opposition, I would say, both in let's say biology and philosophy. So the arguments advanced in the book are not solely that the scientific community has a consensus, but rather I hope the book opens up the debate on the basis of, I mean, there are over 4,000 researchers whose work is summarized in this book. I think that's enough empirical information on which to ground the debate.
Next, let's listen to the sounds of calving seals and colliding icebergs.
Now, even if animals or plants could speak, we couldn't understand them. But the research suggests that we're starting to learn to understand. Are we getting to a point where we could at least envision a development where we as humans could in fact interpret some of this communication?
We're at a very different place than we were 50 or 100 years ago because digital bioacoustics, the large data sets we generate of vocalizations, the artificial intelligence algorithms we use to analyze those vocalizations using natural language processing algorithms that are very similar to what it underpins, for example, Google Translate. All of that provides us with a newfound capacity to detect patterns in non-human communication and to associate that with meaningful behaviors at a scale that was previously unimaginable. So, for example, we've discovered elephants have a very specific vocal label for honeybees, another vocal label for threatening humans, another vocal label for non-threatening humans. Elephants describe us with much more precision than we're able to describe them. All of this is thanks to that combination of digital bioacoustics and AI. I compare it to, in significance, to the invention of optics several hundred years ago. The telescope and microscope combined powerful scientific devices, but they also extended the human imagination. This sonics equivalent is doing the same thing. And there are some science teams. One is called SETI. It's a team of MIT and Berkeley researchers working on sperm whale communication. There's another team in Germany working on honeybees that believe they are at the brink of two-way interspecies communication. So not only can we decode that communication, but we could use it to speak back to other species. Now, I don't think we've definitively proven that yet, but the advances in the natural language processing are so rapid that that may change, you know, within a decade.
And you mentioned honeybees. There's so much interesting research that you've developed about the complexity of communications with honeybees. And so not only, I guess, two questions. One, is there going to be a point, or we're moving to a point where we might be able to decode that even better, and maybe even dream of a moment where we might be able to communicate with them?
Honeybees are an iconic species because, of course, the longstanding work of scholars like Carl von Frisch, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on honeybee communication, the best known example of which is the famous waggle dance, that complex dance that honeybees use to tell each other where nectar sources are. And of course, honeybee language is acoustic and vibrational, positional, the way they orient their bodies to gravity, or the position of the sun because they can see polarized light. So their language is embodied and spatial as well as acoustic and vibrational, very complex. But we have been able to detect a couple hundred different honeybee signals. We don't know what all of them mean, but we know what some of them mean. One is a stop signal, for example. Queens have their own vocabulary. So what researchers are now doing is using a combination of the bioacoustics, recording the sound, and computer vision, recording how the bees move, to refine our understanding of what these signals might mean, together with some amazing research on honeybee behavior. You might have heard of the studies that, you know, honeybees can recognize individual human faces. They can be trained to distinguish a Monet from a Picasso. There was that recent experiment on tool use by honeybees where they learn to use a string to get the honey and then they teach it to other hive members. So as all of this research unfolds, there are some researchers that are using the insights to try and encode artificial intelligence into devices that could try to speak back to the hive. Tim Landgraf in Germany, for example, has invented honeybee robots that go into the hive that communicate specific commands like stop or the waggle dance. This actually has worked in some instances. The team is not sure why, and it doesn't always work all the time, but that's an example of what I mean. You and I may never be able to speak honeybee. I doubt it, but our computers and our robots might be able to. Similar work is being done with sperm whales. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to call attention to this work, because I think we should have an ethical debate in the scientific community about the parameters of research, which involves playback experiments with other species. But also, as you mentioned earlier, I think this calls us to reconsider some pretty foundational concepts in political theory or political science about personhood, about personhood for non-humans, and whether, you know, one day we might have to ask for consent. It may be that what we're doing is a digitally enhanced form of eavesdropping. Is that data really ours to collect? All of these questions are ones that I think we should be actively debating.
This book focuses on bioacoustics and the role of sound. Though we've established that deep listening certainly has existed for an awfully long time. Is it fair to say that the idea that we can learn so much from nature by listening as opposed to by seeing is a relatively new, or at least an alteration in the way that we view science and nature? Sort of, why have we emphasized sight so much more than sound in the past?
So Western science privileges sight over sound. And to some extent that may be because humans, compared to our cousins on the tree of life, are relatively poor listeners. Our sense of sound is relatively weakly developed. But beyond that, I think the advent of industrial modernity privileges sight over sound in a pretty fundamental way. We move from oral cultures and oral storytelling to visual cultures of the printed text on the page. And as we do that, we lose some aspects of our own cultures that may have had a deeper listening tradition. We move to a very visually oriented popular culture, as well as scientific culture. And there have been, you know, from Théal de Chardin or Marshall McLuhan, there are lots of examples of scholars who've traced that sort of lineage and loss of the move from orality to visuality and text-based cultures. So what I think is important to hold on to here is that maybe these are latent capacities. Maybe it's a time to begin listening anew. Certainly, if we pay attention to the onslaught of noise pollution, which is terrible, not only for non-humans, but also for humans in terms of everything from increased risk of stroke and heart attack to dementia and all sorts of impacts on non-humans. If we begin to address the epidemic of noise pollution we face and begin to engage in deep listening again, there are lots of traditions to draw on. And one of the things I do in the book is provide an appendix with some examples of ways different people can get involved through citizen science projects that crowdsource labeling data, apps you can use to listen to nature, sound walks. So the hope here is that, and there are actually hundreds of thousands of citizen scientists out there doing this. It's amateurs as well as professionals. And so one of the things that I hope the book invites people into is sort of adopting a practice of listening to nature in their own lives in some way.
And a wonderful point to end this conversation with, the hope that it just opens up new conversations and new considerations. The book is The Sounds of Life: How Digital Technology is Bringing Us Closer to the World of Animals and Plants. And our guest today is its author, Karen Bakker, professor of geography and an associate at the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of British Columbia, and visiting professor at Harvard's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Thank you very much for joining us.
And we end with the sounds of humpback whales in Glacier Bay. Stay tuned.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What really did happen in the first Thanksgiving? What were the atrocities against Indigenous people? And how should the United States acknowledge those atrocities? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. This week, the United States as a nation celebrates Thanksgiving. Sarah Josepha Hale had advocated for nationalizing what was at the time a New England holiday. And during the U.S. Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the holiday, and it's been celebrated since. The Thanksgiving narrative, what we tell ourselves, we tell our children, we tell our families, is one of coexistence and cooperation. between European, English, settlers, and indigenous peoples, as well as a celebration of the harvest. But the actual history of white America and the indigenous peoples of North America, and specifically at Plymouth Rock, is actually quite different. On today's show, we explore the history of Thanksgiving, what the narrative says about the relationship between those two nations, and what the actual history was, and ask, how should we remember Thanksgiving? And should we be celebrating it at all? Our guest today is Robert Miller. He's professor of law at the Saturday O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He's the interim chief justice at Pascua Yaqui Tribe Court of Appeals, and the author of American Indigenous Sovereignty versus the United States, that's in the Handbook of Critical Indigenous Studies, and a forthcoming January 2023 book, A Promise Kept, The Muskegee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma. And he is an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Professor Miller, thank you very much for joining us. The Thanksgiving narrative is well known, taught to kids really early in grade school across the United States. How accurate is that narrative, this cooperation, sharing this big meal, celebration of harvest? How accurate is that to the history in New England at the time?
Well, I'm a law professor, like you said, and not a historian, but I think it's a false narrative. I think it's probably as false as Santa Claus that we tell our kids about and the Tooth Fairy. It may be what we wish today had happened back then, but that was really not the goal of the English, the French, the Dutch that came here, the Swedish that all settled in what's now the northeast of America. They were looking for empire. They were looking for riches, gold, silver, timber, whatever you can think of. And the kings and queens were looking for colonies and to expand their sovereign powers.
And so was there a great deal of conflict then between the native tribes and the settlers?
I think the history in both Virginia with the first colony of Jamestown, 1606, and the early settlers that attempted settlements in what's now New England, and then permanently after 1620. I think at first, you know, there was maybe trepidation. Come ashore, yeah, maybe we'll sell you some land or you can live there and we'll live here. But the numbers of Europeans that began to arrive and then the obstreperousness and the offensiveness of Europeans caused problems. One thing I would like to dispel. So when was the first Thanksgiving supposed to happen? Is it 1621 or something?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. And so the charter for New England colony that King James I issued in 1620 is very worth looking at. I gave a talk to a Rhode Island Historical Society last year, and I gave a talk just a month ago to a Massachusetts Historical Society on the colonial charter that created the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1629. So in 1620, you have King James I, the successor of Elizabeth I, authorizing a private English corporation. He literally created the corporation to manage a colony in the New World. And in the charter of 1620, James I showed he knew about the plagues, the epidemics that were wiping out native peoples in the Northeast. I can quote this. I'm sure this is a 90% correct quote. He, in his colonial charter authorizing his people to go to what's the New England area, he said, quote, wondrous plagues, and now I'm running out of quote, but are killing the native peoples and making room for my people. I believe I'm pretty accurate that that's the full quote. So he was not sending his troops here, his colonies, his people just to help native peoples or to somehow make them loving subjects of England. No, they were coming here to seize land, to seize assets. And if natives had to be moved, that just was natural. And that was going to happen. So I doubt whether there was a 1621. Maybe there was some welcoming at first, like I said, the first few colonists The Jamestown colonists, I think half of them died in the first year. The New England colonists, half of them died in the first year. And from historical records, I think natives did give them some advice, assist them how to grow corn, beans, and squash together and throw a dead fish in there for fertilizer. Whether they ever sat down and shared food, you know, that's hard to say. Did the settlers have extra food? I don't think so. So if there was any food sharing going on, it was from the native side to these starving, miserable settlers.
Now, I mean, my own interest in memory is the relationship between history and what we teach about history and very much embedded in contemporary politics. So I guess the first memory question, kind of related memory question, is, I mean, this is all taking place, the founding of the national holiday of Thanksgiving, et cetera, in the middle of the 19th century, which of course, partially, I mean, it literally is during the Civil War, but also conflicts across the nation between indigenous tribes and the United States. And by conflict, I mean, wars, battles being fought are taking place during that time. So I guess, what ultimately is telling a narrative about coexistence in a time of conflict between the two sovereign entities, between the tribes and the United States? What's it saying? I know part of this is the inversion of the narrative where the invader becomes the victim and the defender becomes the aggressor.
Yes, I'd like to hear even more about your ideas about memory and stuff. I just thought while you even were saying that, we can only remember what we're taught. And as you also just inferred, the victor writes the history. That's been repeated by so many writers and philosophers, it doesn't even need citation. So we teach our children that, yeah, we're the good guys and we did right. And oh, geez, too bad, just all the Indians died. I have read that 80 to 90% of Native peoples in what's now the U.S. died from epidemics before they ever even saw their first white person, maybe. When Lewis and Clark crossed the continent, Doug, they were in what's now Missouri, and William Clark climbs an Indian earth-made mound, and he says, "There, this is evidence of a great population." This is what he writes in the Lewis and Clark journals. But they see not a native person as they cross what's today Missouri. Maybe the Indians knew to hide out. But anyway, this is just an interesting story, what the true history is. But I'd like to take you one step back, because I was just in a museum in Philadelphia, and they said that George Washington stated a day of Thanksgiving during the Revolution. But as you said, it only became a permanent American tradition with Abraham Lincoln. But I want to tell you something that most Americans don't know at all, and we don't want to know this. General George Washington, and listeners can look this up online in 10 seconds, he wrote a letter September 7, 1783. If you list that date and George Washington letter, you will have it. He was still the general. We had just signed our treaty with England that settled the Revolutionary War for good. Our country's existence was guaranteed, you know, at least temporarily. And they asked, the Congress asked General Washington for advice. And he writes this four-page letter that is called the Savage as Wolf letter. And if you read the fourth page, he finally turns to what Congress and the U.S. should do towards the Native nations. And I can only paraphrase some of it, and then I will quote the sentence that should chill all of us. And we, of course, don't teach this in school. But he says that we can't talk about settling the Western lands and not discuss the Indian nations. He says we have to have peace with them. He says if we're going to take their lands, it's better to buy them than to fight with them. He says it's cheaper to buy the lands. So he was advocating a treaty policy, political, government-to-government relationship that the United States has always dealt with tribal nations. But he then gets into this line and he says, if we fight the natives, he says, it's like the animals that retreat and then come back to fall upon us once we have settled. Then he uses the analogy, the savage as wolf. And this is exactly why this letter is called that. He says, and I can quote this, it is the same with the savages, the savage as the wolf, semicolon. And then he says, both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape. That's a quote. Now, what was our illustrious father of our country saying? Indian peoples are like animals to be hunted. P-R-E-Y, I hope the audience knows. That means it's something that's hunted, something of prey. And I just think most Americans don't even know this. It's kind of chilling to teach it.
Because when you think of American history and conflict with Native peoples, with Indigenous peoples, the president who usually gets identified as the one that sometimes is even taught as a shift in American policy is Andrew Jackson. That is something that is taught, the Trail of Tears and the role that Jackson will play in that. But you're highlighting, I mean, if it's George Washington, and there's numerous other historical examples of figures that we would call founding fathers, early colonial writings that mirror that. So a narrative that tells a story of coexistence, that tells a story of cooperation, invites us to ask, when did that stop? Really, the memory, you know, would suggest it probably never existed in the first place.
I agree with you. And to back up what you just said, yes, Andrew Jackson is blamed for what's called the Trail of Tears. My own tribe suffered a Trail of Tears. We were removed from South Central Ohio, which was a state by then, in 1832, and moved to where we're located today in Northeast Oklahoma. Most people recognize the Trail of Tears with the Southeastern tribes. And let me just tell you something. So Andrew Jackson did not make up this idea. Just as George Washington was advising Congress in 1783 that this is how we settle the Western lands, Thomas Jefferson, through his whole career, had this same idea. And while he was president, Doug, he writes three letters and sort of with the back of his hand. And these are private letters to Indian agents of reservations. I think one general. And maybe in his own diary, he says, well, we all know all the Indians have to move west to the Mississippi someday. Well, why is that? Why is that the case? So Jefferson, as president in 1803, was already thinking of Indian removal. Yet today we blame the terrible Andrew Jackson. You know, he enforced it. He sent in the troops with bayonets. But the whole idea was part of American colonization from 1606. When the English sent the Jamestown settlers and when the French tried colonies and the Dutch and the Swedish tried. The Dutch had colonies for 40 years in parts of New Jersey, of course, Manhattan, and I think mainland New York. So, you know, nothing new, new lands, free. Let's get them for Europeans.
And you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the history, the memory, the meaning of Thanksgiving and the white settler relationship, the conflicts with Indigenous peoples in the history of the United States with Robert Miller of Arizona State University and an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee tribe. Now, the narrative tells the story of, again, of cooperation, of coexistence. When I read this narrative, I think, this seems to be a narrative of what could have been. It's at least an invitation for us to think about how different would the history of Indigenous peoples, the history of the United States be if the settlers, the European settlers, had adopted a different relationship with Indigenous peoples. So I guess the first question is, from your own understanding, is there a potential, is there an alternative historical line where you could imagine where the settlers and Native tribes could have coexisted in the way that was that's described by our Thanksgiving story?
I think not. Let me take one step back. I had jotted something down here I was going to say, and then I forgot. So how quickly did war break out between the Native peoples and the Virginia colonists? I think it was 20 years. The Jamestown was established in 1607, and I believe the first war between the Virginia settlers, the Jamestown settlers, and the Native tribes in the area was in 1627. I believe the second war was in 1647. And in New England, you asked me about that. So the English started arriving by 1620. The Pequot Wars in what's pretty much, I think, Connecticut started in 1637. So peaceful coexistence lasted in those places for about 20 years. But to get back more to your question, I teach this in my classes, and we see it happen. Just as George Washington said, be on good terms with natives when we can. The United States or other European countries would be on good terms with natives when they were weak, and there were not very many of their settlers there. But when they gained the upper hand through, you know, gunpowder and horses and steel against bows and arrows, I think the truth came out. So even as the United States crossed the country, deal with powerful tribes, at first, the first treaty would be very pro-native, maybe. The first treaty would be, oh, we're just here. Can we just have this little corner? We, the United States, can we just have this little corner over here? And then we would wait for, and again, I'm saying we, the United States, was waiting for epidemic, poverty, the change of the foodstuffs, overhunting of the forests, and now natives are desperate. And you see this in the plains tribes when the buffaloes were decimated. The economy and the life of the native peoples changed, and so they had to rely on the United States handouts. And the United States, of course, always put a condition on that: sell more land. So a tribe like my own signed 11 treaties with the United States. I bet the Cherokee Nation signed more than 15. And so they were moved and moved. A famous chief of my tribe in 1831 died about 100 years old. He refused to sign any treaties of removal with the United States. And the line he is quoted as saying is, if we remove once, you will never stop removing us. Maybe I'm a little bit of a cynic or have a little dark view of this, but I don't think there would have been a possibility of equal coexistence because European Christians thought they were superior and God meant them to be superior. They did not think they were just equal.
So this narrative, I mean, this Thanksgiving, as we're thinking about the relationship between the U.S. government, the federal government, state governments, and indigenous peoples, the politics and the legality of these issues are very much front and center. How much is an honest appraisal of the history between the federal government and the tribes? How much will and should that frame these legal questions, like, for instance, the case before the courts on the Indian Child Welfare Act, or the one that you've written about, McGirt versus Oklahoma, and future cases? History as present political issue, as an element of memory. How much should this frame those questions?
Well, history plays an enormous role in Indian law. And even, you know, in most of American law, we look back at history to try to determine what the law is. And of course, we now have six Supreme Court justices who say they are originalists. And the words mean what the founding fathers wrote in the Constitution. Or if you're looking at a statute from 1880, what did the people that enacted that statute mean? So for our founding fathers, you brought up two cases that are actually quite disparate. The McGirt case was about the treaty the tribe signed, and had Congress ever taken it back? And if Congress had never taken it back and never paid damages to the Muscogee Creek Nation, then its reservation from 1866 remains as it was defined in that treaty. So that's a case based a bit on history. It's the borders of that treaty reservation in 1866. If Congress has never taken it back, the court held 5-4 that 3.25 million acre reservation still exists. Now, the Indian Child Welfare Act looks at history a little bit differently, Doug. That's enacted in 1978, I believe, protecting tribal interests in their own children, trying to stop state agents from willy-nilly adopting Indian kids and placing them in non-Indian families, and how that would destroy the existence of a tribal community, take its future citizens. They can't learn their cultures. They can't learn their languages. They're being moved off the reservation. So this is based, of course, in the political existence of Indian nations as recognized in our Constitution. We have finally figured out Congress can pass, well, I say finally, Congress has always passed special laws about Indian nations and individual Indians as citizens of their nations. The very first Congress passed 4 Indian laws in the first 5 weeks of its existence. So here's looking at history, and here's why I hope these justices on the Supreme Court that believe in originalism will look at what the first Congress did. Some of these framers signed the Constitution. What did they mean when tribes are included in the Constitution as a government that the United States Congress has the power to deal with and state governments have no power to deal with? That is pretty much the question of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Can Congress pass a law that treats Indian nations as governments and their people as citizens, and can pass a federal law that gives heightened protection to the children of an Indian nation? The answer has always been yes, but this Supreme Court is being asked to say that that is a racial classification. And as you well know, when the Supreme Court uses strict scrutiny and looks at affirmative action laws, they usually go down.
The Australians have acknowledged the treatment of their own Indigenous peoples and have described it as genocide, do have a day they call Sorry Day. So maybe that could be a good way to consider Thanksgiving as a way for us all to come together and just say we're sorry. And with that, thank you very much for joining us. Our guest today has been Robert Miller. He's professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He's also interim chief justice at the Pascua Yaqui Tribe Court of Appeals. He's the author of American Indian Sovereignty versus the United States in the Handbook of Critical Indigenous Studies, and the forthcoming January 2023, available for pre-order, A Promise Kept, the Muskegee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma, and an enrolled citizen at the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.